today.
I'll open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. I open up a work session on House Bill 2355. Colleagues, we have a dash one amendment on this bill. What it does is clarify. Why is it I don't have it?
It's not very clear.
Maybe you could talk about it, Regina.
Sure, Madam Chair. House Bill 2355 has no revenue impact, and the fiscal impact was issued. The measure alters how funding for lottery proceeds are appropriated to the Problem Gambling Treatment Fund in the fiscal quarter. And the dash one amendment modifies the method for determining the amount of lottery proceeds to be allocated to the Problem Gambling Treatment Fund.
Thank you. So, colleagues, we had a hearing on this. Yeah, we've had two hearings on February 15th and February 25th. This puts a floor on the amount of money that that we put into gambling addiction treatment. So that's all this does. And it was LC who recommended that we do the amendment. So it clarifies when the money would be taken and how much that would be. So any questions about the amendment? Representative Gomberg.
Well, thank you, Chair Tomei. I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 2413.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated 2413. Any discussion? Any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to vote for this bill, and I just want to be on record as saying not necessarily in opposition to any other opinions on this committee, that this is not the only thing we should do or could do about problem gambling treatment. It is not my preferred avenue. I told the chair this the other night. I'm not against this. I just think there are more effective avenues. And I feel that way because of the testimony we've received from Department of Human Services and others. I just have ongoing reservations about the ability, not the willingness, not the attitude, but the ability of the folks that we commission to make as much money as possible from those little machines to also be their own police. Doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing this. I'm just saying on a priority list, this would be the low one for me in terms of effective treatment. But it's a positive, and I'll leave it at that.
Maybe, Representative, you may be confusing the two bills. This one is required by the Constitution. 1% of the lottery proceeds will go into treatment. This does not prevent addiction. It's meant just to treat, not just, but to treat addiction. And this is, as I said, the floor of the amount of treatment money that would go. And I would be happy to discuss with you or anyone else in the future how we can better deal with gambling addiction.
Thank you.
Any other questions? It's been moved that the amendments be adopted. Any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I then move House Bill 2355 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gomberg moves that House Bill 2355 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gaisler.
Aye.
Representative
Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Winsett.
Absent.
Representative
Winsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomberg.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having passed the majority of with that, we will have an informational hearing on the Oregon Housing and Community Services. Representative Gallegos.
Yes, committee colleagues, I just want to introduce the
presenters. We met recently on the housing issues a few weeks ago, and were asked to maybe come back with some clarification on some issues, and this is a team that will clarify things for us. So Dr. Johnson's going to be speaking, and Margaret Van Vliet from the Housing and Community Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rocky Johnson, and I'm here today because I'm an old friend of Joe's, and I'm also here today because I have many years of experience working with housing and community services department for the state of Oregon. There's a handout that you're getting that I will refer to as I go through my remarks. The first part of the handout talks about the agency that I directed in Northwest Oregon for almost 30 years. And the agency was called Community Action Team, and we provided services in Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties. And we received most, if not all, the funding sources from housing and community services. So we're very familiar with that State Department and have a perspective of working with them for over many, many years. So basically, there's three components to the handout. The first is to look at the history of the department in terms of how it came to be in its current configuration. And then looking at some of the impacts of that policy that have occurred at the local level throughout the state of Oregon. And then finally, suggesting some principles as the state moves forward to consider any kind of redesign or restructuring of this state agency. So from the first sheet, you can see that the agency I directed for almost 30 years had a number of different anti-poverty programs, many of which were related to providing housing services at the local level. And you can go through the list and kind of see the various housing services that we were involved in all those years. In terms of how we got here as far as state policy evolution, the next page talks about the Oregon Hunger and Housing Safety Net provider perspective. So that's kind of where I'm coming from in terms of trying to give you that perspective. The history began in the 70s, as most of you are aware. Median incomes began to stagnate during the 70s. The cost of housing began to increase rapidly. And also the increase of single-parent families began to increase. So we experienced, not only in Oregon, but throughout the country, a rising rate of homelessness and people who were hungry. So because of those problems, policies began to be initiated to address them. Everybody's familiar with the war on poverty that began in the 60s. But what happened in the beginning of the 80s with that was that the federal role in that was abolished, and federal anti-poverty funds were reduced and block granted to the states. And so in Oregon, those funding streams were placed in the Department of Human Services and created a new community services section in that State Department. Then in 1985, the legislature acted to require that all those federal anti-poverty funding streams be channeled to the local level and pass through to local community action programs throughout the state. And that policy resulted in the creation of a statewide network of community action agencies around Oregon, addressing the issues of housing and hunger needs throughout the state. Also during that time, the Oregon Food Bank was created. And that, as you know, has come to represent a very extensive network of food pantries and food banks throughout the state of Oregon. So that was during the time that the Oregon Food Bank was created in the state of Oregon. In 87, the state passed the State Homeless Assistance Program legislation, which set up a fund to provide emergency housing assistance statewide. So that was one of the first anti-poverty funding streams for housing that was enacted back in 1987. And then it takes us to actually where we are today was in 1991. The community services section of DHS was transferred to the housing agency, and that became the Department of Housing and Community Services. And so that's where we're at today in terms of that composition of that state agency or that state department. In terms of the impact of this chronology of policy changes, there's two things that kind of struck me, so I wanted to point those out and give you an example of that. And so in the next two pages, what I've done is look at what was going on in my area of the state prior to 1991 and what's been happening since 1991, since the Department of Housing and Community Services has been put into place. So you can see in terms of funding streams, prior to 1991, at the local level, we had access to about four different funding streams to address emergency housing and hunger needs in our area. After 1991, with the combination of those two state agencies, many more different funding streams were made available at the local level. So it really gave us many more tools to work with to address the rising demand for housing assistance and food assistance within our communities. And this resulted in the expansion of the Community Action Network and nonprofit network statewide. So today we do have a statewide network of many agencies in place. And on an annual basis, and the state can probably clarify, but I think over 350,000 people benefit from these services on an annual basis. So it's a rather large impact in terms of the lives of Oregonians. The other policy impact was the With the funding streams being there, we were able, or what happened was a number of new agencies came into existence to provide both housing and hunger-related services at the local level. So I've given you the example in my area of the state where prior to 91 there were two agencies that were providing housing and hunger-related services in Northwest Oregon. Since that time, we have grown to 15 agencies. So you can see the huge increase in local partners that are involved in this effort statewide. And that will be explained further with the other presenters here as I'll describe the current system, which you can see is very involved and detailed and complex. And so I suspect that's one of the reasons why people think we should take another look at it to see if there's a better way to design it moving forward. But you can see just from that example, big change locally in my three counties in terms of the number of local agencies addressing issues of hunger and housing. And this was replicated throughout the state of Oregon during this period. Finally, in moving forward with any kind of restructuring or redesign of the Department of Housing and Community Services, I'm offering some general guiding principles that should be considered in that effort. The first one would be to maintain.
Chair.
Excuse me.
I just had a question relating to the last paragraph.
Sure.
About your three counties. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you have the total dollars allocated to these 19 programs over the last year that you figured out, 2010, 2011, for your three counties. So you have some sort of an idea about
the agency budget that we had is fairly complex and involved a number of different programs, including housing and hunger-related services. We had the Head Start program and other programs. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you what the budget was for the agency, but I can't tell you offhand to break it down just for housing and hunger-related services.
Yeah, I just was wondering what your total CAT.
The agency budget when I left in 2011 was about $8 million a year.
Okay, and how many people did you serve, excuse me?
On an annual basis, we served probably around 20,000 people a year.
Okay, thank you.
Just in that neighborhood. So, and we also partnered with a network of the other local nonprofits and stuff that emerged in the 1990s to address housing and hunger issues. So we had a local network that we work with, and I think that's been replicated around the state. So you have that existing in each county. And Margaret, I think, is going to provide you some information on the agencies in your districts that are affected by the funding streams coming out of housing and community services. So you can get a feel for each of your districts, what the agencies are that potentially be affected. So anyway, moving forward and being brief in terms of guiding principles, the first principle I would suggest and offer up is that any redesign or restructuring of the Department of Housing and Community Services should maintain and enhance a statewide, locally-based anti-poverty network that's currently in place. And so if there's a way to achieve any restructuring so that more dollars are made available at the local level, I think that's a good goal to have in mind in terms of state restructuring, so that there's a net gain in the resources that are available to your local agencies after this redesign is put into place. Secondly, if there's a way to consolidate funding streams to simplify and reduce the reporting requirements, making funding more flexible at the local level, I think that would be a good outcome in terms of any kind of redesign of the state agency. And I give the example of currently there are a number of different funding streams that provide emergency housing assistance. And if those could be simplified into one or two streams, I think it would be more easy to work with at the local level, more flexible, and folks at the local level could do a better job of addressing the needs of people within their district. Also, there are a number of advisory boards and commissions that have been developed over the last 20 years to oversee parts of these funding streams. And if there's a way to consolidate all those commissions and advisory boards into more of a unified oversight board on the part of the state, I think that would be a good direction to move into. I've often thought the state would benefit from an overall poverty commission, which it currently doesn't have, and which would assume a lot of these different advisory groups that currently exist today. And then finally, any redesign should maintain and improve service integration at the local level. So it's done in a manner that reinforces service integration locally, because particularly in a lot of the rural parts of the state, the Community Action Agency is kind of a one-stop place for people to come for housing and hunger needs. And so you need to redesign in a way that fosters that service integration and doesn't add more fragmentation or make it more difficult for clients to access these services. So I think those are three general guiding principles that would be useful to keep in mind in terms of moving forward with potentially this planning process that Margaret is now going to address. As well as Ron. So thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Thank you very much.
So I have a couple of slides, and I'm not sure how I'm going to, I might have to enlist Ryan to help me. Oh, look at that. All right, we have the technology.
It doesn't actually include the money.
No, I think it includes one.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. It's a pleasure to be in front of you again today. What I think we're going to do is pick up a little bit on what Rocky was talking about. And today I want to give you an overview of the system as it exists today. This was what the committee was asking a series of questions about when we were in front of you previously. And then Friday we're scheduled to be back in front of you and talk more specifically about the transition planning effort that's happening for the agency. So with your indulgence, we'll sort of break it into those two parts. Before we get into this, I'm going to give you an example, just a very sort of simple example of why we need affordable housing before we get into the charts and the diagrams. And it is true that I have shamelessly picked a family in Oregon City to demonstrate the need for affordable housing. And so I give you the example of a family, what we'll call them Sally and Bob. And Sally and Bob are both working. Sally works in a clothing store and Bob as a bus driver. Their take-home pay is about $2,400 a month. And I'm going to show you sort of how their budget works very simply, in very simple terms, and I think then this will sort of illustrate the need for affordable housing statewide. So their monthly rent is about $912 in the Oregon City area for a two-bedroom apartment. And then when you add, when they pay for food and daycare, I don't have dollar amounts, but this shows the amount of their budget that's available after they pay for food and the amount of their budget that's left after they pay for child care is $435. So they're pretty much using up a high percentage of what they bring in each month to just pay for the basics that their home, that their family needs. It turns out that they have one car, they can afford one car, and one of them has to take a bus to work, and so that's how they manage transportation costs, and you can see that we're sort of already in the red with this family's budget. If they're lucky enough to have group health insurance, they've got a premium to pay, but they probably have high co-pays, and you can see that they get to be more in the red as we sort of walk through what they need. I think the... I won't go to that quite yet. So I think the point of this is to say, this little family is doing things right, but they're stuck. There's nothing left to improve their education. There's not much left to invest in their kids' future success. And fundamentally, the cost of their housing, the real estate cost, has been and continues to rise much faster than their incomes. We might think of this family as the working poor. And so what you've heard Rocky describe and what I'll describe a little bit more is that all these government programs are really trying to help bridge that gap, right, so that the housing piece of Sally and Bob's budget is more affordable at the end of the day. So this is a chart that I showed, I think, to almost all, to all of you, if not...
That's the network.
On the first day.
And it's a little daunting. And I want to set it aside for a minute and show you something that's a little bit more rational. But I will come back to this. So in response to what you all were asking for when we were here a couple of weeks ago, we tried to show, we created this, and you have a hard copy at your desks that shows kind of the two sides of our agency. On the one hand, we do the community services funding, and Rocky gave you a good history and kind of overview of how that came to be. But what you can see here is that there's lots of different flavors of federal funds that flow into the system in an effort to provide some of the safety net and even the housing pieces. The state also makes investments through a variety of things in this part of our world. Those funds flow to my agency, Oregon Housing and Community Services, but we're really a pass-through. And so kind of at the bottom half, what you can see is a representative list of partners that do that are community action agencies, the Food Bank Network, and other nonprofit agencies who do the delivery on the ground. So I don't want to spend a lot of time kind of diving into the particulars of this. You'll see we didn't attempt to put actual dollar amounts in it, but we're trying to illustrate kind of where the state agency fits in this broader sort of system of federal funds, state funds, and local actors. The other half, if you will, of my agency and the flip side of the handout you have at your desk is the housing finance side. And again, we have very specific streams of federal funds in the form of rent subsidies, development subsidies, foreclosure kinds of assistance, and single-family assistance. And the state also invests through a variety of tools and programs, tax credits and grants and so forth. And those funds flow into my agency. It's our job to administer them, but turn around and get the dollars out to local players on the ground. And again, a representative list. This isn't all of our partners, but it is a representative list, and I hope you'll see some that are in your districts here so you can begin to conceptualize. You might recognize the names of Rose CDC, for example, or NEDCO, or some of the others. So that's the, I think that at least gets partly at the request you had for us to diagram where does the state agency actually fit in this big kind of what seemingly confusing set of systems. The one call out I'll make here, because there was a particular set of questions and it is a common set of questions about where do housing authorities fit, and so you see them on the left side of this chart, and specifically housing authorities get the vast majority of their funding directly from the federal government. At the local level, they provide rent assistance through Section 8 vouchers and also provide public housing. They don't fall under the purview of this department.
Chair.
Do I have a question? Question on this?
Kenny Geyer?
Thank you. I don't see CASA on that. Is that just because there's so many things I can't find it, or it's because it's temporary?
Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, there are two CASAs that receive funding through my agency. I think you're referring to court-appointed special advocates. They are not on there, and so they it does not show everything we do.
Okay, thank you.
It shows the big systems and the big drivers for housing and anti-poverty.
Thank you.
So.
Representative
Whitson. The numbers, I know you don't have them up and on this. Yeah. Do you have the numbers that fit into each of these slots?
Yes, I do. And as it turns out, I'm in front of my Ways and Means Subcommittee next week, so we're tuning those up as we speak. So
okay,
that we
and
can
maybe we could.
Yes, we can. And I'll bring be able to bring, yeah.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Be happy to bring that back. I'm just going to go back a little bit. So it's easy enough to get confused and have it sort of feel like it's looking like this on the ground. And I'll just foreshadow a little bit of Friday for you by saying, you know, I am not, my concern about the system, and we'll talk more about this, but I want to sort of plant the seed today. My concern about the system isn't that the delivery system has lots of actors. I think that's actually a strength of the system. I think the issue is what sits above it is it makes it pretty hard for people on the ground to do their work. And I think that's our challenge. There's a lot of layers of bureaucracy before the good people who do their work on the ground every day get to see a dollar and do something with it for a low-income person. And I think that's really the essence of the challenge in front of us. So we'll come back and talk again a little bit more about that on Friday. We talked about, I showed you my fictional family, and I'll just close with showing a typical development. It's typical in some ways, but I think it is, pretty special in some other ways. This is a development that was built in the last few years in the community of Rockwood in Gresham, and it's called Rockwood Station, I think. It's an amazing project on the ground. It's got a variety of partners, Human Solutions. It has a Head Start facility. There's a Lowe's and Fishes building there. There's a medical clinic, and on and on. And it is a shining example of how a community came together to provide really vital services to needy people. And listed there on the right is the very complex set of financing resources that it took to put that together. And thank goodness we had a local partner in Human Solutions that could assemble all of that. And again, I'm not going to show you how we underwrote that, but just to make the point that we've made it pretty hard for folks. So I'm going to close there, and I think we can... Happy to answer questions before we turn it over to Ryan.
Thank you. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. Go back to that last one, Director, please.
This one?
$1.5 million in private fundraising.
Yes, Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnett. In this particular case, the nonprofit local sponsor did a tremendous amount of private fundraising. They had, a variety of fundraisers.
And that's, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So that's at the basic nonprofit level that's doing that, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Thank you.
That happens all over the state.
Thank you.
That's correct.
I appreciate that.
Any further questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
I'll just say, since I'm on the board of Northwest Health Foundation, that was one of the funders. We're very proud of that project. There's also a cafe there, I believe.
Oh, okay.
It's the residents generated themselves as kind of an income-generating and community gathering.
Even better.
Great project.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
One last question. How many people live in that complex?
Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsett, I believe it's 47 apartments, but I don't know how many residents are actually living there, but it's 47 apartments.
Do you know the square footage? How big? Is it like a block or what?
I believe it's a city block, but I'm not sure. If you'd like, we can follow up with that detail.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Margaret.
So, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I represent the Oregon Housing Authorities, the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, and Neighborhood Partnerships, all of whom are partners with OHCS. I have the task today of describing that, remember that complicated thing at the bottom there? I'm going to try to give you an overview of that in about 4 minutes. So that's what I was asked to do today. I'm going to do my best. But let me start with some good news, some just quick takeaways, if you remember nothing else. First of all, we know what works. And second of all, we've got a good team. Those are two things that I want you to know. And when I say that we've got a good team, I'm talking about this statewide infrastructure of public, nonprofit, private partners that all work together, just as in the example that you just saw. And we all have a shared goal. And that shared goal is to make sure that we've got healthy, safe, thriving towns and cities where everybody has a place that they can afford to call home. And when we get there, we'll have communities where classes are going to run smoother because kids have been fed and have slept in a bed the night before. Emergency rooms are going to see less repeat customers because when they discharge people, they won't be going to a tent, they'll be going to a home. These are the sorts of things that we can get to. And this is what this team is working for. But right now, we've got some challenges. We've got too many people that have to choose between rent, food, shelter, paying bills. There, as the example that Director Van Vliet showed you, we're having to make choices about basic needs, and that's not where we need to be to get to that vision. We need the basics. And Representative McLean came and spoke to a group of folks. The Oregon Hunger Task Force and Community Action Agencies had a day at the Capitol last month, and he came and spoke at noon, and he said, look, when people don't have the basics, when they don't have food, shelter, warmth, then they don't have buy-in to our community. And that's bad for our communities. And he's absolutely right, because when you don't have those basics, you're thinking about the present. You can't think to the future. When you've got the basics, that's when you have the opportunity to think about the future and to do the things that you need to do in order for your life to look the way you want it to look. So one of the things that I hear the folks who I represent talk about when they talk about their work is they say, look, we can't be all things for all people, but there is a continuum of success, a continuum of housing. There are these continuums, and we need to make sure that when somebody comes to us and when they leave, they're further along that continuum when they leave than when they came to us. And that's what our mission here is. We've got to make sure that we are in some way moving people along this continuum. When we talk about housing and we talk about a continuum, I think of three basic stops. And let me first preface by saying, I'm still relatively new to the world of housing. I have this great opportunity to work with all of these people who have been doing it like Rocky for 30 years. But here's a bit of hope for all of you who are trying to wrap your head around this. If a guy like me can figure it out to the point where I'm up here talking to you, you've got a really good chance because, you know, I'm just a kid from Corvallis. So.
Madam Chair, I really appreciate Ryan sharing that.
The major stops on that continuum of housing. You've got homelessness, you've got affordable rental housing, and you've got homeownership. And we want to try to move people through that continuum as best we can and make sure that their basic needs are being met along the way. And in order for people to move along the continuum, we've got to first meet their basic needs and then solve the problems. So we got to stabilize. You'll hear that term stabilizing a lot when we're talking about housing. That means making sure that all those Maslow's needs are met. We got to stabilize so they can move along. So now let's talk about the team that's trying to accomplish this goal. There are a lot of folks in the state who are doing this work, and I'm inevitably going to leave out a lot of folks. There's the Oregon Hunger Task Force. There's the IDA program. There's a lot of folks that partner with housing and community services. But I'm going to focus on kind of four big ones for the rest of my time today. So we'll start with one, community action. Rocky gave you an example of community action in Northwest Oregon. A lot of the community action agencies around the state have the name community action in them, which makes it a little easier to identify them, but not all of them do. So for instance, in Clackamas County Social Services is the community action agency. In Multnomah County, it's a part of Multnomah County government. Most of the parts of the rest of the state, it's a 501c, it's a nonprofit, neighbor impact, central of Oregon, Klamath Lake Community Action out in your part of the state. So those are the community action agencies, and they, like Rocky mentioned, they partner with other local organizations, with nonprofits, with faith-based groups, with county government, whoever is around who wants to help, they're working with them. And they do annual community needs assessment. So they all are looking at, okay, what is already being met in our community by other nonprofits? All right, we don't need to worry about that. That, you know, they're doing a great job, but we've got this unmet need here, so maybe we'll go into this line of work, or maybe we'll help another nonprofit step up and fill that role. As a result, they all look different locally. But they have some things in common, which is that they are meeting needs and helping to solve problems. So some of the things that you'll see in common: emergency rent assistance, like Rocky referred to, emergency or help with your energy bill. When you're in poverty or you're struggling, you get behind on your bills, and that energy bill is a big deal, because if your power gets cut off, boy, that sure does make it a lot harder to go out and find a job. If you can't take a shower, if you don't have food that you can keep in a refrigerator, you know, these are big barriers, and so they're meeting those basic needs. Then they also have services that are going to help, once you're stabilized, solve those problems. So job skills, financial skills, energy efficiency, so that your where you live is more efficient, so that your energy bill is lower in the first place, which makes it easier to keep up with your energy bills. These are all the sorts of problem-solving things that we see within the community action agencies, and the list would go on and on. So that was number one. Number two, the food banks. We've got an incredible network of food banks around the state that are helping to meet those emergency food needs. 20 regional food banks, 945 partner organizations. They deliver food boxes or make sure that over 250,000 households get food boxes every month. That's meeting a basic need, and that's that local infrastructure at the community level that's happening. But in addition, they're also solving problems: nutrition classes, gardening classes, working for community food security. These are goals of theirs as well. All right, so there's number two. How am I doing on time? Number three, we'll talk about the housing authorities. Again, another organization that I get the honor of representing here in the building. A lot of them have the word housing authority in their name, so that makes them easy to pick out. A few of them don't. Housing Works in Central Oregon, Home Forward in the Multnomah County area are housing authorities. Director Van mentioned, the housing authorities get their Section 8 funding directly from the federal government, right to the community level. Same with public housing, although the federal government has not done a lot of new investments in public housing in some time. Housing authorities also work with the state to develop affordable rental housing. So there are a number of different partners that will work to develop affordable rental housing, like the example that was shared with you, and some housing authorities do that because they have the they see the needs, they have the expertise of managing housing, and so it's something that they do if there's a need in their community. Some of them also have some things like job training and some of these other services. Unfortunately, at the federal level, the funding for those has really been restricted, especially lately, and sequestration is going to have a really big impact on housing authorities. So there's not as much of that happening at the housing authorities, but they do partner with other organizations. So finally, number four, the nonprofit sector. And you'll hear the term CDC, and I know that we don't use shortcuts here. So community development corporations, these are nonprofit 501Cs, and they do a lot of different things. But one of the main things that they do is similar to what we just described, develop affordable rental housing. So they blend these different funding streams, they raise private funds, and they make these very hard projects pencil out so that we can build them in our communities. They also are very involved in home ownership. So you'll see regional housing centers where there are home buying classes. I bought my first home. I needed a class to understand what the heck was going on with all of these different forms and inspections and, you know, how do I get my credit rating fixed from the credit card I got in college? All these sorts of things are really important tools if you want to buy a home. In addition, down payment assistance loans or down payment assistance grants can be the difference between whether or not you can purchase that first home. Also, they provide services where possible, again, job skills, micro-enterprise. A lot of the CDCs partner with the individual development accounts, and again, the list goes on. So There's some overlap here, but I wanted to give you a very broad overview. Those are some of the four organizations that you're going to see in your community. You probably already know who they are, maybe just weren't aware of the connection to housing, or maybe you were. But this is the team, this is the network that's in place, and one thing that I can tell you is that these folks are motivated, they're mission-driven, and they are ready to do what we know works, which is make sure that people have a safe place to call home. That's my testimony.
Great presentation, Ryan. Thank you. Any quick questions? Representative Penny Guy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a fantastic presentation. You all live and breathe and know this so well. I think that's probably more true in this committee in general, among many of you here, than maybe in some committees, really. Just very heartfelt and a great representation of the past, the current of what we have now, and I'm looking at you, the future. We had heard on Section 8 some of the discussions that are going on with HUD around waivers to have some flexibility in that system. And we've certainly tried, gotten waivers for our CCOs. So I'm just wondering because I really appreciate what you were saying about on the ground, how, we know that the federal funding comes down because they, at the federal level, to allocate this, have to justify with data why we need to invest in home ownership and how we're doing with that fund and why, all of those. And I keep wishing that we could pool the money, as we're doing in the CCOs, get waivers for that, have the people on the ground who are trying to, fill out the reports on home ownership and rental assistance and energy assistance, all those things, be able to have block money on the ground, report back on it, and then they could disaggregate that back to the feds. So are you having... Is that a direction that you're interested in? Are you having any discussion with HUD around a larger waiver, not just Section 8, a larger de-silo funding?
So Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, I think that has to be what we aim these efforts towards, is more flexibility and more ability to let locals make good decisions about what is going to work in their community, not to leave them high and dry, because not every community has the capacity to do that kind of planning work and gather those resources. But where they do, I think we should get out of their way, and I think that is really a huge part of what I want us to think about as a go-forward look, is what's the most helpful role for state government in that big system? And can we provide capacity? Can we provide the linkages and think about things like waivers so that we can do more block granting? Mm-hmm. We want to have good accountability, but we also want to foster all that good creativity on the ground. And so I think, it's hard for me to see through the fog of how we actually get there from where I sit today, but I think that's not where we ought to be aiming. Did you want to add to that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, I think one of the positive things that's coming out of this conversation around Section 8 from this legislation that's been introduced is that there are more people aware of how those federal regulations affect the ability of the local housing authority to meet community needs. And we have in Oregon, in Home Forward, an agency that was granted what's called moving to work status, and that is a pretty broad waiver that allows them a lot more flexibility. Now, HUD only limits a very small number nationally of housing authorities that are allowed to have that waiver, and we've tried every different way we can think of asking to try to get that spread around so that other agencies, housing authorities, could have that. One thing that we want to ask is, could we do some kind of a demonstration project where the entire state gets that sort of status? And we have a lot of high performers in this state in terms of the housing authorities. And so we think that we are a good state for and candidate for that. And landlords and tenant advocates have all expressed an interest in wanting to help us make the case that we would be a good state to get this flexibility. So that's something that we're hoping to do.
Follow-up. Thank you. So the other question is, have you had discussions with CCOs? Because this is so integrated into social determinants of health. And so, I know the ELC, the Early Learning Council, is looking at how to integrate with CCOs. So I'm wondering what kind of conversations you've been having and at what level.
Right.
Is it you and Bruce, or, do you have local people in all the CCO regions?
Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, at the moment, it's only been me and Bruce.
Okay.
So, excuse me, Dr. Goldberg. What we'd also know is at the local level, many of our partners are already doing that, right? They're naturally invited to or getting themselves invited to the table where the CCOs are talking about how to make things work on the ground, and the health providers are sort of understanding, oh my goodness, we better have a housing piece here or we won't be able to get the results and the impacts that we want. So it's happening on the ground, but I do think there's more work we need to do at the state level to really institutionalize that.
One more note?
Last follow-up.
Thank you. So in the CCOs, they have community advisory councils, mm-hmm. and if you want to institutionalize, it seems like there could be a really good opportunity there to have a person representing housing community services mm-hmm. on that.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
If I may, Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, one of the things that our statewide organizations have done is brought people from OHA to come and talk, and we've really encouraged our members to get involved, and both on the community action side and the housing authority side, we have members that are participating in those community advisory committees and are very much involved locally with the CCOs.
That's great. Thank you.
That's good news. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I want to thank you very much. Thank you, Chair, for giving me a chance to mm-hmm. thank these folks for their presentation. I too agree that it's very helpful and clarifying, and I want to follow up on Representative Kenny Geyer's point. I think that, you know, and I've mentioned this before, what housing represents is really, to me, very much a central sort of connectivity to healthcare, to education, to job security, all of those kinds of things that will help us to help the families, working families out there. One thing I do want to maybe suggest, maybe in addition to Rocky's three points, recommendations, was that from my perspective, looking at the way housing support is developed, human services, period, we've just moved to a lot more partnering by necessity over the past 20, 30 years. And I would like to suggest that you include then maybe another recommendation that we look at private partnering, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. With our housing, I think is a great example of how we've been able to partner up with not only federal support, but state support, nonprofit support, but the private sector as well. And if I'd like to see us take more advantage, I think, of that private sector partnership. Thank you.
Any last questions? Thank you so much. Great presentation. You helped clarify a lot of the questions that we had earlier meeting. So thank you very much. With that, and thank you, Representative Gallegos, for putting this group together. And we will be hearing this again,
next episode, Friday.
Right, good, next episode. Okay, with that, I'll close the informational hearing on housing, open up the public hearing on House Bill 2477, and a public hearing on House Bill 2850.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2477 has a revenue statement issued and no fiscal impact and a subsequent referral to tax credits. It extends the sunset for the earned income tax credit to 2020. House Bill 2850 has a revenue statement issued, no fiscal impact, and a subsequent referral to revenue. It raises the percentage of federal earned income tax credit allowable as credit against Oregon personal income tax in each of four consecutive tax years. It first applies to the tax year beginning on or after January 1, 2013.
Thank you, Regina. So, Senator is here. Senator Dianne Rosenbaum. Representative Betty Comp, is Betty here? She might be here pretty soon. Jason Gettle and Patty Whitney Wise. Wonderful. Welcome to our Human Services and Housing Committee.
Thank
Senator.
You very much, Madam Chair. And I'm sure Representative Comp will be along shortly. So, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Dianne Rosenbaum, the state senator from District 21, which is Southeast Portland, Northeast Portland, and Milwaukee and Oak Grove in Clackamas County, and I'm very proud to be Representative Tomei's personal senator. Mm. So I'm also equally pleased to be able to appear today and to thank you for holding hearings on House Bills 2477 and 2850. And these are two separate bills which deal with Oregon state earned income tax credit. And you'll hear, I think, in great detail from some of the witnesses you're going to hear from shortly about why this is such an important feature of Oregon's tax policy. But I just wanted to start by giving you just a little context. This state earned income tax credit, which is a percentage of a federal credit, was actually created here in this building in 1997. And the chief sponsor of it at the time was a fellow, I don't know if any of you probably never served with him, but Senator Brady Adams, who was a banker from the southern part of the state, Grants Pass, in fact, was the one who really promoted the state earned income tax credit. And I think he did that because he really understood that we have lots and lots of low-income working people supporting children in this state who are really challenged every day at the end of the week to just be able to pay the bills. And this was a way to be able to help those folks put a little more money in their paycheck at the end of the week to be able to put food on the table, get the car fixed, to get to work, to be able to put their kids in shoes to go to school. And those are really the folks that we are talking about. So the bills before you today, basically the first one, House Bill 2477, will extend the sunset on the state's current earned income tax credit. This is... Hi, Betty.
Hi.
This is a program that has benefited already about approximately 719,000 hardworking Oregonians who are working at tough jobs and low-wage jobs, and it represents about 250,000 medium and low-income families around our state. And one thing that we thought you might find of interest is to see just who those people are in your own personal district that you represent. So we brought fact sheets for each member of the committee, and perhaps my friend Jason could give them to you. But before you take them away, I just wanted to point out, Madam Chair, that in your district, in House District 41, there are 4,194 people who directly benefited from this earned income tax credit in 2010, and that represented children, too. It represented 5,500 children in your district. Representative Witsit's district actually has the very highest usage of the earned income tax credit in the entire state of Oregon. In that district, which is District 56, there were 14,300 households that benefited and 7,000 children. And so I think one of our points here is that this is something that is benefiting low-income households all over the state of Oregon. And we're talking about people who are working mostly full-time, almost every one of them with children in their family. And this small amount of benefit from this credit is being spent immediately in stores and businesses around the state in each of your districts. So the bills before you, as I said before, House Bill 2477 would just extend the current credit, and that is something we really need to do. It will expire at the end of this year if that bill doesn't pass, or some form of it. And when you think about it, this would be an immediate, if we didn't do that, this would be an immediate tax increase on 250,000 low-income households around the state. I don't think any of us wants to be responsible for doing that. But we can do more than just extend it. You know, I'm well aware, and I think we all are, that when the co-chair's budget came out a week ago Monday, there were lots of things that were funded. One of them included extending the earned income tax credit, but it was also on a list of things to prioritize to expand it. And And if we find ways to be able to do that, that's where House Bill 2850 comes into play. That bill is almost a placeholder bill because it takes the current 6% credit and expands it to 18%. That's something that our broad coalition, including the Hunger Task Force and others that you will hear from, have been trying to do for a very long time. During the recession, unfortunately, it hasn't been possible to find funds to do that. And I would just suggest to you today that as we're looking at very tough choices this session, people who are working full-time and not able to even pay the bills, keep the lights on, keep their kids in shoes, ought to be way, way toward the front of the line when we're talking about who deserves to be rewarded for working hard every day and doing the right thing. And that is what these bills represent. So I think our coalition that you'll hear from shortly are fully supportive of the renewal of the sunset, fully supportive of the expansion that was in the governor's recommended budget, which would be adding 2% and putting it at 8%. I think this is money in the pockets of the exact people who deserve it, and it's money that will be spent to stimulate local economies in every one of the districts around the state. I can't think of anything much higher in priority that we could do, so I would just urge you to be able to send these bills to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits so that they become part of the discussion about our top priorities. And thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for coming today. Any quick questions, Senator Bobby? All right. Representative Betty Comp, how nice to see you. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you, Chair Tomei and committee members. It's always an honor to come and present, but I will tell you that this is not an easy testimony for me today because it is very personal. For the record, my name is Betty Comp, and I serve House District 22. I come today before you today in support of House Bill 2850, which increases the earned income tax credit. Today, I'm not here just as a legislator, but as an Oregonian whose life has been greatly impacted by economic hardship. As a child, I grew up with 13 brothers and sisters on a small dairy farm. Although my siblings hate it when I use the word poverty, it is the most fiscally accurate way to describe our less than ideal situation growing up. This is the same circumstances far too many families in Oregon are experiencing today, as Senator Rosenbaum just shared. As a young single mother with four daughters in my life, it was full of blessings. But once again, we were lacking in luxury. We only lived with the basics of life. I was a full-time student, worked part-time, actually two part-time jobs, and had a taxable income in my sophomore year of approximately $7,000. There's a typo in there that wasn't 1981, it's a later year. Every penny that came in the door was highly valued. I received Pell Grants. I received state aid to assist in my education, but every single month I struggled to find ways to pay for groceries and the utility bill, let alone the prom dress my daughter was asking for. I worked extra shifts. I took on every opportunity to add dollars to our budget. When I filled up my taxes that spring, I realized I qualified for earned income tax credit. It literally made it possible for me to continue my education as I was at a decision time as a sophomore, finishing my sophomore year, whether I could afford to go on to my junior year, because I had to travel a lot longer. Pay for gas and take care of an automobile was not generally my priority. Colleagues, I know that we sit and debate about hundreds of millions of dollars every day. A small amount like $200 or $400 seems rather insignificant, but for hardworking families like mine that are low wages and struggling to afford basic necessities, a few hundred dollars can change lives. House Bill 2066 is about fairness. It's about protecting our families. And during these incredible difficult times, it is necessary. I respectfully ask for your support. Thank you, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions, either of these two witnesses? All right. Thank you both for coming to testify today and bringing these bills to us.
And I know Representative Gilliam's going to vote aye, so.
You can count on that. Okay, next we will hear from Jason and then Patty Whitney Wyatt. Thanks again, both of you, for coming today.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. For the record, my name is Jason Gettle. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of both House Bill 2477 and House Bill 2850, and more generally in support of renewing and strengthening Oregon's earned income tax credit. Working families with low incomes have earned the earned income tax credit, and I urge you to ensure that it continues to exist. As I'm sure many of you know, many Oregonians work in jobs that pay too little and thus struggle to get by. Many even live in poverty despite the fact that they work, and some even live in poverty even though they work full-time. In fact, when looking at families with children in Oregon, 6.3% of families in which at least one parent worked full-time still lived in poverty in 2011. And that same year, about 7 out of every 10 children in poverty lived in a home in which at least one parent worked. The Earned Income Tax Credit helps these families that work but still struggle. It supplements the income that they earn in order to help them make ends meet and to help offset other taxes that working families pay. It is well targeted to effectively and efficiently reach those families. In order to qualify, not only must someone have low to moderate income, but that income must be earned through work or possibly through a small business. As you heard earlier, the Earned Income Tax Credit helps about 250,000 working families with low incomes, and these families are located all across the state. And in 2010, in those families, there were about 719,000 Oregonians, and that included about 350,000 children. And on average that year, in each house district, there were roughly 4,400 working households that received the tax credit. And living in those homes in each district were about 12,000 Oregonians, about half of whom were children. Taken together, this means that about 1 out of every 6 tax returns all across the state received the earned income tax credit. If the credit is not renewed, these families will have less income and be less able to provide for themselves. For example, a two-parent family of four earning just enough to live at the poverty line would have about $300 in less annual income to meet their basic needs if Oregon's earned income tax credit expires as it's currently scheduled to do. And remember, this would happen to about 1 out of every 6 households across the state. The federal earned income tax credit is widely recognized as one of the most successful anti-poverty programs for families with children. In 2010, the federal credit lifted about 6.3 million people, including about 3.3 million children, out of poverty. Oregon's earned income tax credit builds on that success. There are more than 20 other states that have their own earned income tax credit that supplements the federal credit, and these range from about 3.5% of the federal credit all the way up to about 40% of the federal credit. Oregon's current 6% credit is on the low end of that range. As I said before, Oregon's earned income tax credit effectively and efficiently boosts the incomes of low-income working families, especially those families with children. It requires very little cost to implement and almost no bureaucracy at all to administer. At a minimum, I urge you to renew Oregon's earned income tax credit and strengthen it to 8% of the federal credit, as the governor has recommended in his budget. And further strengthening the credit would be a great way to support low and moderate income working families that are struggling to make ends meet. Renewing and strengthening Oregon's earned income tax credit is a small investment that the state can make, but it can have a large impact, not only for the individual families that receive the credit, but also for the local communities in which that credit is spent, and for Oregon as a whole. Thank you very much for your time today, and thank you very much for your important efforts to renew and strengthen Oregon's earned income tax credit.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions here?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gillies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you mean 18 or 8 or so?
I said at a minimum, expanding it to 8% of the, Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, I meant at a minimum expanding it to 8% of the federal credit as the governor has recommended in his budget. But it, going beyond that would would be a great way to further further assist low-income working families. So increasing it to 18% would be a great way to do that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. Patty Whitney-Wise.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney-Wise, the director of the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And to just build on your question, one of the reasons we've been pushing for an 18%, that's a 18% earned income tax credit, is that we're one of a few states in the country that tax people on below poverty wages. There's just a few of us. And if we moved our state credit to 18% of the federal credit, we would no longer be taxing most families on their below poverty wages. Now, obviously, if they're below poverty wages, they need every dime to help meet their basic needs, including food. So that's why that's been our goal for these many years. It does cost a chunk of change, although I would argue that that investment back in local communities all throughout the state would help create additional jobs, and I'll cite a couple of places that talk about that specifically. So I want to talk just very briefly about a couple more stories of people and how it impacts them, and then some of the literature that supports the success and why the Earned Income Tax Credit is such a successful program for families. So I have a story from Orion Lumiere, who isn't able to be here today, and I quote, "I am a hard-working single mother of two young children. Almost half of my monthly income goes to child care, and that is even with assistance from the YMCA. Each year, as I struggle to make ends meet for my family, I benefit from the state earned income tax credit. It allows me to put some money in savings and use it for emergencies throughout the year, like car repairs and doctor bills, instead of racking up consumer debt that would destabilize my family. In turn, the money I spend for necessities is spread through my community everywhere I take my business." And David Leslie wasn't able to be here from Ecumenical Ministries today, but he allowed me to share a story of one of their employees, Howard. So Howard and his wife were unemployed due to the economic recession, and both had college degrees. In fact, he was a PhD. At the time, they had children living at home, and the economic stress was really frightening for them. Finally, they were able to find part-time jobs, but still struggling. Thankfully, as he said to me recently, and this was David recounting this, they discovered they were eligible for the federal and state earned income tax credit, which was a blessing, living on the edge as they were. Now, Howard works for the emergency food program in Northeast Portland, helping other families go through what he struggled with. He and his wife are doing fine. So another story of a family who really benefited from the earned income tax credit to make it through that transition to more stability. And we at the task force consider the earned income tax credit as a part of a three-part solution to family economic stability. The other two programs you know much better. The temporary assistance for needy families program for families who need some help stabilizing and getting the job skills to move into a job. The employment-related daycare program that once they get those jobs, then they have some help with child care if they're in a low-wage job. And then the earned income tax credit that helps them keep more of the paycheck that they're earning in order to meet the rent and the utilities and the child care and the food that are part of their budget in an ongoing basis. So for us, those three programs together help to stabilize families as they move towards success and getting off of all of the assistance programs. At the end, I'll give you more information on those, and as well as a document that we put together that addresses some of the tax credit questions specifically. And I would like to end with some information from a couple of economists about how important this earned income tax credit is to families. So according to a California economist David Newmark, using the EITC, earned income tax credit, to create jobs confers four advantages. First, it does not create it does not create stigma effects. Second, it is easy and inexpensive to administer. Third, worker subsidies such as the Earned Income Tax Credit do more to help low-income families. And fourth, there is clear evidence that the Earned Income Tax Credit increases employment. And I'm sorry, I don't have the note on Good for Our Feds. So this second one is from Earned Income Tax Credit, Good for Our Families, Communities, and the Economy, from the National Community Tax Coalition. And the quote is, the Earned Income Tax Credit ensures that business customers' base have more to spend, thus helping arrest and beginning to reverse the downward spiral of layoffs and cutbacks. And then finally, a report released last year from the Sociological Review did a long-term study on families who both were accessed the EITC and those who were not able to, the Earned Income Tax Credit. And what they found is that those families that had the Earned Income Tax Credit had children with better health, improved infant health and well-being, and that that led to long-term reduced negative outcomes. So the way I interpret that is you invest a few dollars up front, help these families stabilize, help the moms have healthy babies. Down the line, they're going to be more productive as adults, and you're actually that in upfront investment yields you much more down the line. You're not putting in all those extra costs, whether it's in remedial education or whatever, in that child's life. So we've seen a lot of research in recent years about the importance of the 0 to 3 and how important it is not to have too many stressors in families. So I look at this and say, Earned Income Tax Credit helps those families have a better sense of stability, have a little money set aside for those emergencies, which then helps them be more calm with their children, and those children have a more stable environment and can do better in school and as they grow into adults. So for all those reasons, we support the increase in the Earned Income Tax Credit. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Patty. Patty, you were here, I think, for the previous presentation.
Yes.
About housing, and
yes,
we were shown a slide about a family. Let me see. Do I have that here? The family in Oregon City?
Right.
And it showed what they'd paid for
Correct.
Housing, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct.
And they were in. So you can't do it now, but it would be really helpful if maybe you worked with somebody, you got that family, and showed us what their income tax would be and what it would be if they had the Earned Income Tax Credit, both the 6%.
Right, both the federal and the state.
And
I'm going to look to Jason for that, and we will work together on this with the Oregon Center for Public Policy.
We'd like to see that.
Absolutely. We can get that within the next
few days. That would give us a graphic example of how this does help a family. We're sort of talking sort of $200, $400, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have in terms of what, in what scale. So that would be very helpful.
Be happy to do that.
Great. So we have quite a few other people here to speak. Thank you very much. I assume there were no questions. Did I ask if there were questions? Okay. Lee Mercer, Jessica, Jemay Wright, and John Mullen. Good to see you.
Chair Tomei and committee members, and a special shout out to my representative, Representative Gilliam. He's my neighbor in Silverton, and he's known in Silverton as a true community servant that picks up the horse poop after all the parades, and that's a true community servant. So
not we can even gonna go there.
We won't make extrapolation on our jobs. Yeah.
Don't get so close to the mic.
Okay, I do that all the time. Sorry. So my name is Lee Mercer, director of Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We're a statewide network of small business organizations. We currently have 1,200 small businesses in our roster around the state, and we're building a statewide circle of small business leaders. We're here speaking today in support of HB 2477 and 2850. This year, as Oregon state legislators, you have the opportunity to make sure that 250,000 Oregonians have more spending money in their pockets to spend in their local communities, and by renewing by renewing and strengthening the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit. This has a benefit for businesses and communities because working families will have more money to cover basics such as groceries, rent, utility bills, and car repairs. EIT spending reaches every community in the state. Low-income workers will be able to cover work-related costs such as transportation and child care, thereby strengthening our workforce. And this I actually learned in advance of this session. I wasn't aware. Many small business owners themselves who file for taxes as individuals receive the EITC and to help support their families, educate themselves, and keep their businesses going. More than 14% of filers nationwide with small business income claim the EITC. So we've submitted a letter from Main Street Alliance small business owners signed by 22 businesses around the state, but I wanted to just read from a couple of them. From a farmer in Clackamas County, it's a win-win. It provides basic necessities for families who are unable to fully provide for things for themselves, and precisely because these families so badly need the boost, the monies they receive go immediately into local economies, giving the economy a boost. Better fed and clothed kids, more jobs, no-brainer. From a small business owner in the Columbia Gorge, I've had situations where my income was compromised, and the Earned Income Tax Credit was a huge benefit to me and my family. It is not necessary for me now, but as a stopgap or safety net, it was a lifesaver. From a jewelry store owner in Eastern Oregon, in Joseph, actually, I live in rural Oregon where these benefits have a magnifying effect. The EITC, Earned Income Tax Credit, brings more circulating dollars into the local economy. From a gift store owner in Eugene, Oregonians are struggling to meet our local economies or keep our local economies afloat. Let's help working parents and families circulate money here in our local communities by securing important tax credits. From the owner of a small town appliance store, many years ago I was a single mom. I received the EITC, and it helped me in many ways to improve my family life. Please keep helping the hardworking people in this country. And from the owner of an arts and crafts store in Yamhill County, we run a business which works with many customers who are reentering the workforce in physical therapy, are only able to be partially employed, and who struggle to make gainful employment pay for their basic needs. They make for some of our most loyal customers as they appreciate the specialized attention, solutions, and service local small businesses provide. EITC lays out a path for working families to become a vital part of the economy. As you can see, around the state, small businesses are supportive of the idea of extending, increasing this Earned Income Tax Credit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony.
Oh, I can't have that too close. Hello, I'm Jessica Cheney from Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. And I testified before you not too long ago about the TANF program, so you probably remember that I was on that program for a while. My children were very small. And the last time I was here, I talked about a time when I had been offered a job, but I was unable to take it because there was no transitional benefits to help with that gap in time before your first paycheck and all the expenses that you have. And when you have children that young, you can't be without any income. But eventually, I did get off the program. And when I did get into a job, the Earned Income Tax Credit became a very important part of my family stability and moving out of poverty. So just to kind of think a little bit about to that time, again, it's last time I talked about transitions from TANF, but really the first couple of years in transitioning into employment, when you have young children, and you have that kind of low income, there are a lot of things to consider. With a new job, you have new expenses, and you have things to think about, like your car, and because you can't make it to your employment without your car and without having car insurance, but most importantly, without having reliable transportation. And that was one of my issues, was when you're low income, you go through a succession of pretty bad-looking cars that are on the edge, and in many cases unsafe. I drove way too long on bald tires and put off unnecessary repairs and didn't go on trips to the park or other kinds of things with my kids because my transportation was unreliable and I didn't want to risk being on the road. Getting to and from that job was really important. And the first time that I got my Earned Income Tax Credit check, that helped me purchase more reliable transportation, and that was critically important for me and the stability of my family, but also in keeping that new job that I had. The next year that I got my Earned Income Tax Credit, because I was still in a low-wage situation, there were some back bills, and it was my utility bill included, and that allowed me to kind of zero out at least that time of the year. So again, when you're having, when you're a low-income person and you have all these expenses, and like you saw the family up there, that was a fictitious family, but I could really relate to it myself because you do feel trapped. You, when you don't have much of an income, you don't have much choice in life, and so you have to work with what you have. And when you have the earned income tax credit, it's incredibly valuable. And sometimes, you know, you think about it as just being a few hundred dollars, but when you're a low-income person, that feels like a couple of thousand dollars because you can do some of the things you've been putting off and haven't been able to do. So I wanted to share a little bit about my story, but I wanted to also make bring home the point that it really, I really feel like the earned income tax credit is important for long-term stability for families, really keeping them stabilized, allowing them to maintain that employment. And I feel like I am more of a success today because of investments that were made in me by both the federal and the state government, both through the TANF program and other supports that I got, but also through the earned income tax credit. So I feel like that was a definitely a good investment in both myself, my family, but also in my children. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions?
For anybody on the panel, do families without income qualify for EITCs?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, no, it's an earned income tax credit, so you have to have earnings in order to receive it.
Is there a, excuse me, follow up, is there a federal program that gives people money back when they don't have an income that you know of?
Representative Whitsitt, can you clarify just a little bit?
Yeah, I somehow had the impression that there was a program that would actually give people money under these earned income tax. Somebody's shaking their head back there. So all the money would be earned. Mm-hmm. So there's no contribution from the state that isn't already earned by the family.
No. No, it's a tax credit on earnings. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen here today on behalf of the Oregon Law Center and the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I'm going to be very brief in my comments. The Oregon Law Center works on behalf of low-income people. This has been on our legislative agenda for years because we see the value of people being able to move ahead and in many instances not needing the services that we provide through our attorneys around the state. Secondly, about the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, Representative Gelser knows well from our discussion down in the House Revenue Committee that we often take a wary eye of tax expenditures and want to make sure that they measure up as we look at things that are done through committees down here and in Ways and Means when we're working on the budget. But the Earned Income Tax Credit has always had the support of the Human Services Coalition because we see the effect that it has on families. And we're very interested in seeing the sunset extended. And we also are supporting at least up to the governor's recommended change, moving it from 6% to 8%. I want to end by just thanking some people for their leadership and courage. Jessica Shanae, who you just heard from, and Representative Betty Comp, who told their personal stories. But I also really want to acknowledge that Senator Rosenbaum has been a real champion in the legislature for the Earned Income Tax Credit, and that the Oregon Center for Public Policy, all of those wonderful charts that you have, the work that the Oregon Center for Public Policy has done over the years. I think one thing that I would leave you with from the discussion that goes back to the beginning of your committee, when you look at all of the spider webs of all of the different organizations and services they provide, I think it's also good to know that we coordinate our advocacy efforts and we look to work together wherever we can to bring before you consensus on a number of things that we want to work on together. And so in that regard, again, just thank you for your consideration about the Earned Income Tax Credit. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank my friend for that shout out. As you know, that job prepares me for this job. John, I'll use your terminology. Are we going to agree on tax expenditures at this moment?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I'll resist the urge to say what's on my mind about tax expenditure, but just to say that, at least for this narrow discussion,
that's all I'm asking.
I think it's really important to point out that at the national level and also at the state level, there has always been broad bipartisan support for the earned income tax.
Okay, follow-up, if I might, Madam Chair. So the benefits of this program are unrefutable.
You're good.
Looking forward, this is just a question perhaps for you or anybody on the panel, some of those in the room. Is there a place you could see as we go forward raising the rate that it would become a disincentive, not just because of the individuals? These are working people that clearly want to make their lives better for their children and so forth. But is there a place in our tax code and a place here where you would find a disincentive to keep going after we keep raising the earned income? Is that a fair question? If there's not way, if you can't calculate that, I understand, but I'm just wondering what your response is.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I do think that's a question that sometimes people ask about any number of human service programs. My experience of 22 years running an organization at the local level, that I saw people very, very interested to make their lives better for themselves and for their children. I often think of the earned income tax credit as a way to really help make work pay, and I didn't invent that phrase. And in fact, it was Ronald Reagan who said that he believed the earned income tax credit was probably the best anti-poverty program that exists. So I don't think of these in terms of disincentives. I do think that it does help to make work pay. Hmm.
Patty, you look like you.
Yep.
Yes, in this particular program, Madam Chair, and Representative Gilliam, in this particular program, Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force. In this particular program, the more money you make, the less you get in the earned income tax credit. Mm. So it has a slope down. It's not a cliff. It's a slope. So there is no incentive to stay on the program. There is every incentive to keep going.
And Madam Chair, that's a helpful answer. I'm just wondering, is there any place there where I understand the slope and at some point you're out, but maybe you've already answered it, but I just wonder if there's any calculation that says, it's hard to go the next route. I'm going to stay where I am.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, Patty Whitney Wise again, and in this instance, the slope is gradual enough. So there is a place where it does plateau for a little while, but you're still making pretty low wages, and it's not a dollar for dollar. So the slope is gradual enough that it actually is an incentive to keep going. I would find it hard to figure out a family that would think that it's better to stay at a lower wage given that.
Thank you for that answer.
Okay, I'm still back on what I was before. Is there ever a situation where more money comes back to a family than they earned?
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Whitsett, Patty Whitney Wise, and this is a refundable tax credit. I think that might be what you're trying to get at. So if you make very low wages and you're eligible for a certain amount of tax credit, you may get back more than you paid in taxes.
That's what
it's
I'm
not
after.
A lot of money, but it is a little bit, and it helps to meet those basic needs. It acknowledges that at very low wages, it's really hard for you to meet your basic needs.
Thank you. That's the answer I was looking for before. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, if I could say one more thing, just that I neglected to mention Patty Whitney Wise as the coordinator of our Working Families Coalition, and I just want to thank her for all of her hard work. We all look forward to working together on all of these issues, but she deserves some praise for her work.
Mm-hmm. She does indeed, both through all four of you. Thank you very much. And it's good to hear from small businesses. We need to hear that perspective. Thank you very much. We have Richard Myers, Marcia Kelly, and Philip Kennedy Wong. And please identify yourself.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Richard Myers. I'm policy manager with Children First for Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. Children First for Oregon supports both these measures and the earned income tax generally. I'll keep my comments very brief. What we would like to emphasize is the very real child impact that the earned income tax credit has, and also how that translates into savings in the short term and then in the long term for the state. So about one in five children in Oregon live in poverty. And we know that a childhood in poverty correlates to a whole host of adverse outcomes, right? A child in poverty is more likely to end up in foster care, less likely to excel in school, less likely to graduate. And then even longer term, a childhood in poverty is more likely to lead to chronic health problems. And actually, the list goes on and on. Now, there's a very real human element that I don't want to ignore to these outcomes. But there's also a state fiscal element, right? So short term, we'll pay in terms of child welfare dollars. Longer term, we'll pay for public safety, health care. And so that should be one of the frames that this conversation is viewed in. How are we helping the children, and how might that translate longer term to benefit in the state? So again, I'll just keep it simple and leave you with that. If you want specific dollar-to-dollar comparisons, I'd be happy to provide those. But again, a wise investment, both in the human element and in a fiscal sense, in our state's children. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, thank you for the opportunity to present to you today on these two bills. Oregon Food Bank does support both of these bills. We support the extension and the expansion of the earned income tax credit. For us, obviously, hunger is really connected to income. And I'm taking the advantage of sharing with you this handout. Looks like you are about to receive it. So I'll wait just a couple of seconds. But as you are waiting to get a copy of this report, I want to take a few seconds to explain what it is. Oregon Food Bank Network is essentially, probably the best way to describe what we do is that we are the food distribution system for nonprofits all across Oregon. We have 20 regional food banks that serve as sort of like the warehouses that local churches, food pantries, and other programs go to get their food because it's cost effective and they can get it for free because a lot of it's donated. But we can also use the advantage of full purchasing power and be able to buy some staple food products in the food bank network. So having the ability of connecting with 945 local outlets, we take advantage of that by conducting a survey every year to find out why people are going to emergency food services. And as you can tell from this report, it gives you a sense of some of the reasons. And I wanted to point out to a couple of the charts. One is obviously why emergency food, and you'll see that a lot of the items there are income related. Ran out of high food costs, you know, and running out of SNAP benefits is also income related, obviously, but on a different level. High cost of gasoline, high cost of heating, rent, mortgage, so on and so forth. And if you take also look at the breakdown of who's been going to food banks as far as the ages and household composition, it gives you a pretty good picture of who it is that are, as far as families and individuals experiencing hunger. So I think that for us kind of brings us back to why, you know, we see the earned income tax credit as an important tool, because obviously food banks can't provide for all of the needs. We recognize that what little we can provide to these families do help them in terms of their household budget, but we also recognize that we need to have tools like the earned income tax credit to help them to be able to pay for other of the expenses of what it takes to survive here in the state of Oregon. So that's pretty much all I have to say, and I want to thank you again for the opportunity to present to you.
Thank you. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. We have about 2,000 members in the state, both in branches and members at large. And we're, like many of our other cohorts around the country, in AUW, in public policy, in state levels, advocating for the earned income tax credit. I take any amount that you'd increase it to for the families in this state that need it. Should never follow a state senator, because she used what I was going to use in giving you a pop quiz. We have a lot of members who are in the education field, and so I was going to just challenge you to figure out who had the most families receiving the credit, but we already know that, or who has the fewest families receiving the credit. So it happens to be Representative Whitsitt, and the combined buying power for the families who receive the earned income tax credit is over $11 million when you put the federal credit and the state credit together. And those are dollars that go directly into the community to buy the shoes, buy the clothes, feed the kids. It's not something that's not used in the community. And so that strengthens communities that are struggling. And we all know that lots of communities are struggling. What's really interesting when I took a look at the numbers is Representative Gelser and Representative Olson are pretty close as where their legislative districts are. And there's a real difference in the numbers of families getting the earned income tax credit in just your two districts. So it can be just right across the street, your neighbor right across the street could be using your income tax credit. At any rate, just to sum up, these are dollars that come back to our families and really, really help them to help stabilize because they spend it in the community. And that's one of the very important things that we should look at, the good that tax credits do when we do increase them. Thank you very much for the opportunity. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is this the last penny guy? Last panel?
Yes.
Okay, so this may be a question for Patty, but you may be able to answer this. So we're one of, I think, 8 states that start taxing people below the poverty line. And yet our state EITC is, whereas most are between 3.5% and 40%, we're down at 6%. So it's kind of a double whammy on low-income families who are working. We start taxing them. We give them very little break. Is the 8, and the rationale for the number 18% is that that would bring those families up to, as if we didn't start taxing them until they hit the poverty level, as most states do. So my question is that 18% the state and federal combined, or is that just the state? So 6% of the federal EITC plus 18% of the state would bring our families up to as if they weren't being taxed up into the poverty level, correct? That's the rationale behind the 18%.
That's the rationale behind the 18%. And the 18% is 18%, Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. The 18% is this 18% of what they receive in the federal earned income tax credit.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll get the answers. And Patty can probably do that or some really good mathematician. But yes, and I've seen some states refund up to 50% of the federal earned income tax credit.
Okay.
I can't tell you which one because I looked at it last week.
So this is 9%. It just, starts creeping us up from our current 6 to the ideal 18%. I mean, maybe ideal is more than 18%, but the 18% that would get them as if they weren't taxed if they were below the poverty line. Thanks for that clarification.
And we'll get the exact information. Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering, what is the upper limit for the combined income for a family of 4 to receive the earned income tax?
Patty. Patty's coming.
I just read it, but I want to make sure.
Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force, Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsitt. I believe it depends on family size, but it's in the range of $44,000 for a family of 4 is the top, and at that point you get very little. So it's that slope again.
Okay, may I follow up? Do you anticipate that if we move this up to 18% that in effect, Oregon would be paying out or back more EITC dollars than it takes in? Going back to my first question about the families that get money back, more money back than they pay into it. And I realize that would be a function of how many families but do you anticipate something like that?
So, Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsett, the cost to move to 18% from our current 6% would cost the state about $150 million a biennium additional. And that's because we have 260,000 families applying for it. In terms of, I think you might be getting at the refundability issue again, are you, in part?
Yes.
So there would be a little, so on the refundability side, it would mirror what the federal tax credit does. And so to the extent that the family's wages were very low income, they would be eligible for some refundable dollars if they're at a certain level below the poverty level. And we can get you the exact information. It's not a simple calculation, but it's a calculation.
Hey, Philip, I'm concerned about loss of revenue to the state of Oregon, and that's what I'm getting at through all of this, is what is and how are we going to make up that lost revenue to the state?
So, Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsett, the loss of that revenue still goes to Oregon families, and because they're low income, the likelihood is that money will go right back into the economy. And in most of the economic models that I have seen, the earned income tax credit creates additional economic activity to the tune of about $1.30 to $1.70 for every dollar in earned income tax credit. So while that money does go back to the communities, and the state would have to figure out how that works into the budget, I understand that piece. Yeah. There would actually be additional economic activity that would return some of that money back to the state.
Okay. Thank you.
And it might be a good idea to meet offline.
Absolutely.
And
happy to.
This. That would be great. All right. No. Oh, wait. Yes.
Doing it right now?
Okay.
I don't want to miss the vote on this.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2477, 2850, and I'm opening up a work session on House Bill 2477. I'm holding that over. Close the work session on 2477. Open up the work session on House Bill 2850. Close the work session on House Bill 2850. So I'm also to announce that we have a letter in here from Duke Shepherd on both these bills. Please look at that, what the governor recommends. And Representative Comberg.
Yes, Madam Chair. I was afraid if you banged the gavel one more time, I wouldn't know where we were. I'd like to move that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Wisnett to vote on the motion to move 2355 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gomberg moves that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Wisnett to vote on the motion to move House Bill 2355 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Wisnett.
Aye.
Any objection or discussion? Apparently not. Okay, so Representative Wisnett voted aye. With that, we will close whatever I do.
That's a work session on that bill.
Okay. Yes. Any other business for the House? All right. See you on Friday. Close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.